Hello, and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark, and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Our topic of discussion today is three possible scenarios we see for the Chinese economy on the back of the current market conditions. This is, of course, very relevant to the Australian economy because of our existing trade relationship with China. And to discuss this further, our hosts today are David Llewellyn-Smith, Chief Strategist at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, David.
G'day, Mark.
And Damien Klassen, Head of Investments at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damien.
Hi, Mark.
I hope we are doing well, gentlemen. And before I hand over to you, a quick housekeeping message. A reminder before we get started, please do subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live or when we have a new webinar that you can watch. Or alternatively, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. For those listening in live, feel free to drop in questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. Now, gentlemen, over to you.
Thanks, Mark. So Dave's going to do most of the talking for this one as, our resident China expert. But I think that the key thing we've been talking about in previous weeks is this whole idea that will China have a hard landing? And will you see this real growth slowdown? And I think the longer it goes on, and the more announcements we see from the Chinese government, the more it looks like that they're actually serious about the slowdown. We've seen similar slowdowns in 2012, 2015, 2018. So what we really wanted to do today was sort of paint the picture and look at the evidence we're getting that we are headed for a more hard landing. But we're certainly, that's certainly not locked in yet, and there's a number of different paths this can take. So, with that, I'll sort of give a bit of a background, and then maybe Dave can step into the scenarios a bit more. So, the key thing to remember for China is it's very much an investment led economy. So I've got a chart up here just sort of showing the residential gross fixed capital formation, so basically investment in the residential sector, and you can see that it's far above other markets like the Japanese market or the US market that had these major housing crashes. They're spending an extraordinary amount of money in the Chinese housing market. Now, a lot of that has been moving people from countryside into cities, and so a lot of it's been around this whole idea of the construction of houses for these workers. The issue though is that there's a whole bunch of issues that come out of that. One issue is that the amount of building you do is reliant upon moving more and more people into cities every year, and it looks as if China's going to have to finish up pretty soon. We ran a few models on it recently. They really have been going foot to the floor in terms of the number of people moving into cities, and most countries sort of tap out somewhere in that 70 to 80% range, and they're getting close. And so there's 64. Just a genuine, yeah, they're at 64. So coming from 30% a few decades ago. So they're closing in on that level. This is the point where most economies start slowing down. As they get closer, because it just gets harder and harder, and it's called the Lewis turning point. Is that you're moving people out of your rural economies into manufacturing economies, and you just run out of the workers that to move across. So that's one issue. The other thing is, so what that results in for China is that they spend more money on investment than pretty much any other country. Well, sorry, not pretty much than any other country. Not only that. Any other country we have recorded history of, and they've recognised this, and they do want to make changes. They have tried a few times to change back to a more sustainable model, and the more sustainable model requires more consumption. So it basically means that households in China simply don't get much of the money that comes in. So in other countries, households get most of the money and they pay out some in taxes and you get some corporate profits, and that's your sort of model of the economy. In China, because of this, there's such a huge amount of CapEx, most of it which has been focused on houses, you just don't see that money come through. So what that means is they want to convert to a more consumption-led model. We had a few different reform attempts, and we spoke about it in detail in some of these other shows, but, you know, 2012, 2015, and 2019 are the big ones where, and you saw that hit commodity prices, where basically what would happen is they would try to put some reforms in, the property market would slow too much, and then they would then panic and go back to the sort of old ways again. But each time they are putting through more and more reforms, and what that means is it actually gets harder each time to because of the reforms that have been put through, you then have to reverse some of those reforms or try and skirt around them. And then go and put up, you know, a lot of these reforms were for good reasons. So, for example, in 2012, was all about getting local governments to actually tap the bond markets rather than just, you know, directly lend from banks. And what that meant was a lot fewer bad debts because there's a market discipline. 2015, sorry. Yes. Yeah. What were some of the other ones that came through? There was the most recent ones are all about the red lines, so about limiting the amount of debt that property contractors can have, with the idea that if you're limiting the amount of you don't want these things to pull down their economy when it all turns bad, and that's partly where some of the problems at the moment are coming from in terms of Evergrande and the issues there. So, you know, we know China wants to convert, and we know they have to convert at some stage. You know, we've likened it in the past a bit to the Soviet Union in terms of it spending with, you know, in an arms race with the US, and that meant that they could keep the economy sort of propped up for a long time with this military spending before eventually the whole thing fell apart. And China is sort of in a similar position where they're building these apartments, not putting people into them, and then building more and knocking down more apartments to build more apartments. It keeps people employed, but you know, there's an end to that in terms of and the amount of debt they've had to keep adding. So it doesn't have to end right now. It could last for years longer, but it is getting harder and harder and harder as they keep going through this process.
And at the end of that, of course, if you persist with it, is what is known as the middle income trap, which is where a development model doesn't want to go. That's when you pull up. Your development essentially pulls up before you're rich, before your middle classes are high income and can drive that consumption. Your economy stagnates into overinvestment and basically the inability to service all your bad debt. So that's what they're trying to get around.
Yeah, we've had some high profile ones that did make it through. So Japan made it through and South Korea made it through, but there's lots and lots of those ones David was talking about that did fall into the middle income trap. You know, whether it be places like Russia or Brazil or Cuba and places like that have sort of tried to pursue these models, but then it ended up all falling into the middle income trap and never actually getting out of it.
Yeah.
So, and that's the challenge that China faces.
Yes.
What about, if I could interject here, what about if you have this migration from rural to urban, what happens to the farming? Doesn't it have to be an increase in the efficiencies of the farming to allow for the loss of all these people?
Oh, absolutely, and that's been occurring. Like that's a lot of the system, a lot of it's just replacing systems that they see elsewhere, and that's the part that's quite easy to do in terms of okay, we can see how other countries have automated these farming processes, you know, rather than having one farmer to, you know, per 10 acres, you can get one farmer per 100 acres or whatever it is. But that means there's nine, you know, when you do that, there's now nine farmers that need to go and find jobs elsewhere. And so that part's relatively easy because they don't have to create anything new. It's just, you know, applying technologies I've seen elsewhere. And that went right throughout the Chinese economy. In it's not the only industry, like there's lots of other ones like coal mining was very famous there 10 years ago because there was literally coal mines in people's backyards. They'd go out and dig up all these coals, and of the coal they had, you know, so much of it had come from just literally backyard operators. And then as you move up, you know, those people, they started banning those things because they were very unsafe, and you start bringing in mass automated processes and you become much more efficient. And those people then go on to work in iPhone factories putting iPhones together.
So with that background, let's have a look at what they're doing today and see if this time is different, bearing in mind that As Damo said, we've been here three times before, and each time they've ended up panicking and opting for broad-based stimulus again, which has always sent the property market ballistic and, accelerated more property investment and empty apartments. So the first thing to note in terms of why this time might be different is the broader reform agenda, the scale of it and the nature of how it's being communicated. So we've seen over the last 6 months or so reform proposals and rhetoric attacking all sorts of sectors, some of them new economy, some of them old economy, everything from tech through to education, property, more recently entertainment, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more. And all of these are coming together under a rubric of policy called common prosperity. Now, why this is really important in terms of making this reform effort different is the key challenge in doing these reforms is not actually the economics. The economics is very well understood. You know, the winners and losers are well understood, and that's why you do it. The key challenge is political and who those winners and losers are, who has the power, and who can disrupt what it is that you're trying to achieve. And so at base, it's a political communication challenge. You need a regime of some sort that you can hold rent seekers' feet to the fire, as it were, those that you want to break. Like in this case, if you're talking investment, it's things like local government overinvestment, obviously property developers. We had the broader stuff with tech billionaires, but that's kind of peripheral to this. SOEs,
but part of this as well is, isn't it, Dave, is that you sort of get any economy that goes through this, and you know, there's a number of other advanced economies, you know, suffering the same problems. You'd probably pull out Australia as one of those cases where whatever regime has benefited the most from the last, you know, the last 5, 10, 15 years, it ends up being the regime that then has the most money and then can lobby the government and pay
absolutely
what it needs to pay absolutely to try absolutely and keep the regime from changing and keep
that's
keep going to that.
That is exactly right. And that is why you need a very big, very potent rhetorical regime to fight them off. Hmm. Right. In other words, you need to be able to carry the whole polity with you, even in a tyranny, right, where they still need to be popular. You need to be able to carry the community with you on your reform agenda while those vested interests are kept at bay, the ones with all the money and the policy lobbying power. And so that is a key difference with what we're seeing today, with what we've seen before in 2012, 2015 and 2019, where the rhetorical umbrella under which most of this is transpiring, which is actually the number one challenge in making it happen, is much bigger, much stronger, and much more granular as well. So, for instance, we're not just seeing Xi, you know, wax lyrical about common prosperity. They've also deployed their internet sniffers so that anyone who says anything negative about reform is instantly erased from the internet, and possibly erased in reality as well. Who knows? But the point is that they've actually got this communication part of this right for the first time, and that actually suggests that they're going to give this a red hot go. So that's the first point to make about why this is different. The second point is this is really a continuation of the 2019 reforms or reform period, which Damo mentioned before, which were interrupted by COVID. But underneath that have continued on and are now being entrenched. And the main ones on this are in property. Property's the key here, as the chart shows. This is where the major overinvestment is. The list of reforms that have been deployed in property are really impressive. But there are a couple in particular. Three red lines is the one that's a real killer. where they're simply deleveraging all of their property development sector, such that they simply can't invest at the same pace that they used to, because they can't get the debt to amplify what they're doing. So that has started to throw up major casualties, as Damo mentioned, things like Evergrande. But there is like an incredibly long list of stuff that they've done under this three red lines rubric.
And also continue to do in terms of, like, there's some stuff that I find, gives this argument some support, is that, you know, you put the three red lines out and things start to slow down, and obviously these developers will be squealing and talking to the people they've given bribes to, and, you know, explaining how they need to reverse a lot of these, is that then one of the ways they got around it was these property developers started going to private equity and then, you know, issuing effectively what was debt, but really just pretending it was private equity. And that's also been cut off. And so it's actually not just here's one rule and let's try and push that. It's actually going, well, how are people getting around it? Okay, we've found that way. We cut that one off. Yeah. What's the next way? Cut that one off.
No, you're right. It's dynamic, and they've corralled them wherever they've gone. Mm. And even though it's continued to slow.
Yes.
And all the while continuing to double down and double down and double down on this rhetorical strategy as well. And so they're all in a political sense on this. Now, that doesn't mean they can't backflip. Like, they're politicians like any other politician. They can always backflip, but there'll be a major loss of face if they do, much more so than any previous reform attempt. And so from the point of view of what this is going to do to markets and timing, we see a better effort here that will take more to turn them around. There's probably one more thing I would mention just in terms of why this time is different. And that is there's a strategic necessity to this now that hasn't been present before. That is, you know, the kind of Cold War 2.0 context, you know, deglobalization and trade wars, all of that stuff coming together in strategic vulnerabilities for the Chinese economy. And that's everything from semiconductors to iron ore. All of the supply chains going into China on these large growth areas are now seen, quite rightly, as existing within the sort of liberal sphere of influence around the globe, which is turning hostile to the illiberal one led by China. And so there is this strategic impulse for them to do a lot of this stuff now, because it does get them off some of those Western dependencies upon which they can no longer rely. So that's probably the big ones on why this time is a bit different in this reform effort. So why don't we have a look at what we think are the possible scenarios here in terms of the assumption that they are going to go forward for the time being. The first scenario we've put up here, and this is our base case with a kind of, you know, 40-50% probability this one transpires. You'll get different estimates on how much property and real estate matter to the Chinese economy. It's somewhere between, in my estimation, between 13-23%, depending on who you ask and what kind of spillovers you include in your model. And so it's obviously very substantial. So any significant slowdown in the Chinese property sector is going to have a material impact on growth. So we see a material slowdown. It's already in the numbers, and the credit data at the moment suggests it's going to get materially worse yet. So, you know, the first kind of scenario is of this base case is that there'll be a hard landing in what we call the old economy in China. So that is this property sector, a little bit of infrastructure, not so much because they'll try and keep that going okay, but certainly in the apartment construction segments, and probably a little bit in commercial property as well. So if we have a hard landing in the Chinese old economy, but it's contained within there, so shall we say, there are reasons to think that that might be possible. Probably the primary one is that they are spending a great deal of money on the new economy. not just direct fiscal spending, but incentives to invest in tech semis, as described. You know, there's some also going in into commodity, localized commodity production, etc., to try and get off some of those global supply chains. But mostly it's into the higher value-add manufacturing and tech sectors, which we haven't seen with such intensity before. And so that's a pretty decent growth offset as property winds down.
Yeah, and I guess it's also could easily be just a money sink as well.
Oh, of course it could. I'm only talking about the next sort of 12 months.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they'll succeed.
Yeah, but you're unlikely to see any, even if it was going to be successful, though, you're unlikely to see that much success in the next 12 months from those types of things as well.
Absolutely. In terms of producing, in terms of delivering productive economic outcomes, yes. Mm. But while they're throwing bottomless billions at it, you know, they'll get something out of that.
Yeah, well, they'll get employment at least, yeah. But it's interesting that, you know, China's quite good at doing things like, say, solar panels, which is the technology is quite well known. It's just a matter of once you've got it, you know, you replicate it, and you scale it up, and you do those types of things. And so they threw a lot of money at that, and that was, that was successful in that, you know, these solar panels last 25 years or something like that as well. And so, you know, it's not the evolution of those panels isn't that great. But some of these semiconductors, you know, for things like phones and laptops and IT, they change every year or two. And they're the ones you need to not only be at the cutting edge, you need to stay at the cutting edge. And China's been good at doing the very basic ones, the ones that might fit in your old, you know, Casio calculators, but not the latest and greatest stuff and staying near that edge. That really requires a level of expertise that they're just nowhere near. And you have to question whether they'll get there, because you do need innovative programmers, and you need people who are willing to think outside the box. And within a command economy, it's and increasingly a command economy, it's pretty hard to find people who are willing to not think out the box whatsoever in even the smallest bit from a political perspective, but then will happily think outside the box on any other matter. So
yeah. And, you know, you got to ask yourself if you can even become a billionaire these days. So,
yeah, that's right.
It's not that I'm necessarily altogether hostile to some of those measures, but in terms of trying to keep competition up and stuff, there is potential upsides in terms of breaking monopolies and things. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that they're going to do some damage to their
future prospects. Yeah, yeah.
Like private equity capital and speculative capital. You know.
Yeah, and your entrepreneurial class. You know, who a lot of these guys have been to prestigious US universities, your Harvards, your MITs, and things like that as well, before they're coming back to China to launch and start some of these companies. Might sort of look at how, you know, Jack Ma and some other successful entrepreneurs have been treated and decide not to do it in China, but to do it elsewhere.
Yeah. So for the time being, they will have new economy offsets as the property slip market slows. So that's kind of what we mean by narrow fiscal spending. It'll be targeted, etc. I actually think that the growth impact is going to be sufficient for them to be forced to cut the cash rate, or the whatever they call it, the equivalent of the cash rate. Bond markets are effectively almost already pricing that. And they've never cut reserve ratio requirements before without ending up in rate cuts either. And I think that's likely this time. That said, there's no reason to expect that to juice property this time, as long as their prudential measures are still fully in place. Then by that I mean the various lending. There's so many new caps on pricing, rental pricing in property, in bank lending to developers, in the developer leverage and everything else, that I think they could actually safely cut interest rates without sending property on another cycle. And so in this hard landing in the old economy scenario, I think that's still likely. And they, you know, if that didn't get, you know, if growth slides too far, which I think is also very probable, I'm talking about, say, 4% GDP growth, but in reality, it's going to be less than that, like probably more like 2. And so they're going to slow a lot.
So when you're saying that, though, David, you're saying that the headline number, the officially reported number, would be 4%.
Yes.
But the underlying number would be 2.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, that might be 4 to 5 and 2 versus 2 to 3, whatever it is. It's a material slowdown. And the property sector itself, I think, will be in recession. And you can see in this chart here, this one's from Nomura. This one's just a measure of property developer leverage. And recent financing locally and abroad, and you can see it's down heavily year on year. It's likely to continue to go to carry on. So in short, there will be monetary easing, narrow fiscal, and then some of the prudential measures may slowly come off as well if growth just continues to fall. So that kind of scenario, I will come back to what that'll do to various markets. So that scenario 2 is that this becomes, you know, the kind of epicenter of a broader hard landing for the Chinese economy, that there simply isn't enough offset in consumption, which has been struggling to rebound out of COVID, and not enough investment in the new economy to offset it. But to get there, we probably need, you know, a credit event of some sort. And the obvious candidate for this is Evergrande. Or something like Evergrande, where it goes under, isn't resolved in a smooth manner, as we did in, I didn't mention that, I don't think, actually. The assumption in the hard landing only in property was that Evergrande is resolved peacefully, if we can call it that.
And other ones as well. Evergrande's just
absolutely.
Yeah, they're the elephant in the room. But
whatever debt resolution is required out of the property developers is managed without it turning into a crisis. Mm-hmm. However that's done, whether a Chapter 11 or 13 process equivalent in China, whatever.
Let me just give context for Evergrande as well. So Evergrande is a company that's, If you look at what its equity plus its debt is worth together, it's sort of 150 odd billion. It used to be probably closer to 300 billion. And the problem is that of it now, you know, there's I think less than 10 billion now in the is the equity, and the rest of it's all the debt. And then the debt is actually trading as if it's going to go broke as well. So this company is it's a massive property developer. You know, at other levels, it was the biggest property developer in the world, and it's certainly the biggest property developer in China. But it's now at the stage where it's trading as if it's going to go broke.
Well, it is going broke.
Yes,
it's only a matter of how. It goes broke from here, but it is going to go broke. You know, its bonds are now trading 30 cents on the dollar. Like it's out of business. And so some of that counterparty risk is already starting to reprice markets, like in the property segment, especially in junk bonds for developers. I've got a chart here showing the degree of kind of tail risk repricing on that basis, and that's going to get worse before it gets better. Now, and there are a couple of other things coming towards China that could exacerbate this.
Let's just go through that chart really quickly. So the bottom ones, the triple C companies, which are the ones that are already in default or close to, are sort of trading there on, what is that, 45% yield or no? 176% yield. 176% yield. So yes, so it's basically if you want to buy dollars worth of debt, it'll cost you, I don't know, to ride back probably sort of 20 something percent. And of what it is, with the view that, you know, the expectation is this thing's going to go broken, you're not going to get all your money back. But then these next levels, these B rated properties, you know, can't borrow it below 15%.
Yep.
So it's getting it becomes a bit self-reinforcing in the stage of some of these companies that then go, you know, they might have otherwise been able to borrow at, you know, 5 and 6%. And then they turn around back to last time they did it, and they've got these bonds expiring that they paid 5 and 6% on, and things are getting a bit dicey. And all of a sudden, that jumps from 5 or 6% to 15%, and that then is pushes them over the edge.
And then if you have an Evergrande incident where it simply defaults on somebody, and then you get a counterparty risk shock, then all of those spreads and interest rates can just blow out instantly to uneconomic levels for everybody in the segment.
Or you start seeing property house prices fall because of Evergrande just flooding everything they can.
Well, they're already liquidating properties, both developments that they hold plus new apartments they're trying to build. They're discounting everything like crazy. So this is already a tremor in development, a pretty decent tremor in Chinese development. But if it actually seizes up, then it becomes a kind of Minsky moment in this entire segment or sector. And, then what is contagion just becomes a shock, and we'll see a sudden stop in some of this development activity. And that could combine with what we've been talking about for a few months with the global inventory cycle turning down, which is where China's been getting a lot of support through very strong exports. Consumption hasn't been very good, and if house prices were to roll into this at the same time, then you do have the scope for a hard landing in the wider Chinese economy. Now, this is not our base case, but it's a pretty substantial risk case. We're not talking about Lehman Brothers here, where like the Chinese banks don't go out of business on this stuff. But a lot of these developers rely on markets for funding these days, not banks. And so it's more difficult for them to simply, order banks to lend and get around dyspepsia and debt resolution. That's partly what they want, right? That's what they're trying to achieve here, is get away from being able to simply prop these things up so that they can make their capital efficiency better over time.
And that was a lot of the reforms that have happened over the last 10-15 years have been because back 20 years ago, when the government turned around and told banks to lend, get out there and lend, they did. And it ended up, a lot of it ended up in bad debts that then had to be sort of brought onto a central part. So the idea was, if the more market discipline you can give these, then the less likely you are to end up in that position where all these debts go bad. But given where they are at the moment, they're going to have to take their medicine first before they're going to feel better.
Yes, and so obviously that scenario, if it were to transpire, would probably, not absolutely definitely, but probably lead to a reversal in a lot of these policy reforms, the fiscal and monetary tap being turned on in a panic, and off we'd go for another wasteful cycle of misallocated capital and overbuilding. Which brings us to scenario three, which is basically what I just described at the end there. Chinese authorities panic in the near future. Evergrande's bailed out. Three red lines policy is reversed. Fiscal and monetary tap turned on. Bang. It's off to the races. 20% probability we put on that. Pick a number. I think it's low. And for the reasons already described, they look like they want to give this a red hot go this time. That said, scenario three, obviously, if you think of it in terms of sequential scenarios, then it's quite possible that either scenario one or scenario two could lead to scenario three. So it's not a fixed point in time. The point I'm making is I don't doubt that the Chinese authorities still have the firepower to do it again if they wanted to. And so if they do panic, it's possible. And it may just be that they have to go through this process to get there, or they have to go through this process and they don't do it.
Yeah.
Which is probably a low risk scenario that they don't do it. But you never know.
And look, 6 months ago, though, we were talking about, as we're discussing the risks internally and saying, what's the biggest risk to this is that Chinese government will flip earlier than everyone expects, and we'll just go, oh, well,
yep,
we're just going to keep running this. We know this. We know this won't work, but let's just keep running it until it runs into a wall. Whereas the longer this has gone on, the more support we've had for the view that actually they are serious this time.
Yes,
they do need.
They have doubled, tripled, and quadrupled down all year.
Yes.
Really, the only offset that they're talking about is a little bit more borrowing in local government special purpose vehicles for infrastructure, but they have struggled to get that done anyway. And because local governments are so tied to the development sector, most obviously because of land sales and that being a very large part of local government revenue, we don't think that they're going to be able to manage to get a lot of that off the ground anyway as an offset to the property slowdown. So, excuse me, basically almost everything has been in the one direction for the last 6 months, and that is towards reform. We did have the reserve ratio cut, of course, but that was narrow as well. So no, they appear determined. So the major takeout for the next 6 to 12 months on that basis is that it's going to take a lot more pain for them to stimulate. That's the base case. Whether or not they eventually do is a second question. But for the time being, on your investment horizon, they're going to need more pain before they do. That is the base case. Okay, so then we were going to go through the basic scenarios for markets.
David, before we get into that, we have a question here. Alaska Vapor. Yep. I think you might be covering it now, actually. What is your 5-year outlook for the Chinese economy? You've covered 6 months to 12 months. We're discussing scenarios of how it's going to land, but what's going to happen after that?
I don't know. I simply don't know. What I can say is this. Whether or not this is the moment where they embrace reform, if you go out probably 10 years, then they're stuffed anyway on property because they'll have an urbanisation rate of 80%. There's no useful scope of or people to bring into cities anymore. They will have so massively overbuilt everything that they will slump into an extraordinary middle income trap. They'll be Japan on steroids in 10 years if they don't change.
Right? But also with much lower Japan, but with much lower incomes.
Yes, poor Japan. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's 10 years. In 5, if they were to not reform, then you'll start to see that process transpire. And so you would just see growth continuously step down. I'm talking about in 2030, basically them struggling to grow at all. Although on the headline, that might look like 2 or 3%. It'll actually be zero, virtually. By 2025, you would start to see that. You will be seeing that trend down continue. If they do this reform, like if they stick to it, now, what they'll get is a growth shock up front, and their growth will shunt lower for a couple of years as they resolve the whole property sector and redistribute their capital into more useful applications. But then they'll have a higher growth rate coming out of that because they'll have much stronger product and more productive areas of their economy.
But they've got, I guess, more importantly, they'll have a chance of escaping the middle income trap.
They will,
because of the political things I was talking about earlier. There's actually,
Interests. They'll have higher productivity.
Yeah. I was talking about the whole not being able to get the. States, they need to have actually genuine, innovative ideas and differentiated product.
Yes.
I think they'll struggle to do that. But I guess if they go down the reform route, they've got a chance. If they don't go down the reform route, they've got no chance.
No chance. Exactly. Well, they can steal it, but that by definition is coming second. So, in that sense, I suppose my 5-year look. Outlook for the Chinese economy could be actually promising or it could be really grim. And I don't know which way they'll go. So I'm sorry I can't answer your question with greater clarity, but it looks fairly diametric.
Well, I guess the message in there is stay tuned.
Yeah, I guess so. So on to, you know, what these scenarios mean for markets. So scenario one, which is the hard landing within the property segment, which is our base case, I see this as driving iron ore to $100 or below before the end of the year. That seems really extreme, I know, but if you understand commodity economics, it's actually pretty logical. Excuse me, because it means we're going to see property demand fall away quite quickly. One component of the reform agendas is lots of steel output cuts, and what that does effectively is take weak steel demand and shove it upstream into the raw producers that supply there to that sector, and they do it basically accelerates pushing the weakness into raw materials, and so you're going to end up with a glut in iron ore very quickly because there's lots of supply coming on now that was knocked out because of Brazil, but also Rio, and so then you know to stabilize the falling iron ore price, the only way to do it sustainably is to get it down to the highest cost marginal producer, and that's below $100. So I think we're going there very quickly. As we've discussed many times before, we think base metals follow iron ore down. Things like nickel, which are incredibly dependent on stainless steel, and copper, which takes, you know, squillions of tons into the Chinese property sector as well, should overwhelm anything anywhere else. And so we'd expect base metals to track iron ore, you know, eventually, even though there'll be offsets for the financial bid coming from the Fed and Wall Street. We'll see what we've been mooting for months now, a growth scare coming out of China and then sort of reverberating through markets, then that should be enough to correct equities. I'm not talking about the end of the world here, but just a, you know, your standard gummy bear, 10-15%, enough basically to knock the Fed's taper off course, which I think is already happening, but would be done more officially. The Fed would basically be just forced to wait on its taper, because we'll have a falling Chinese yuan, which will be smashing emerging markets as it always does, and all of the inflation panic globally will give way to a deflation scare. Australian dollar falls from, you know, somewhere just around 65 cents or above, and that's your gross scare scenario coming out of a hard landing in Chinese property only, that's contained to Chinese property. So if we go to the broader Chinese hard landing, which would probably take a little longer, we're talking about into 2022, then iron ore's in real trouble. And we would see it, I think, you know, follow the 2015 path quite quickly and end up sub $50. Base metals get hammered. And rather than a gross scare, we'd see a gross shock coming out of China, which would punish equities a lot more, forcing the Fed to print again, as a falling CNY starts to create really serious contagion into emerging markets, and you'd have the usual kind of reverse cycle going on with a safe haven bid into the US dollar, and, you know, everything kind of unraveling in a deflationary bust, and then in that scenario, you're going to get an AUD plunging to 50 cents or so. And then scenario three, you know, where we get a swift resolution to this with a bailout for Evergrande and a quick return to fiscal stimulus and turning on the broad credit spigot in China, the removal of all of these prudential measures, a rollback of reform, then iron ore can probably hold $150. Even though supply is rebounding, but then the Fed can go ahead and taper, and you'd see global bonds back up. You'd see growth equities in trouble and value equities ripping higher,
Basically, a rerun of the first half of this year.
Yeah, and a strong US dollar. A weak US dollar that would boost all of this. But you'd still see the various structural problems surrounding Australia, its relationship with China and emerging markets, etc., which mean I don't think the Australian dollar goes crazy or anything, up to 80 cents perhaps or so. And then of course, in 18 months, we have this same video again as China hits the brakes and has to confront another attempt at reform. That's the wrap on the implications. The base case scenario one, a substantial risk case of scenario two. Scenario two, three, quite a low risk case. But of course, it's possible that if, especially if you had scenario two, where you had a serious hard landing in the broader Chinese economy, then you would get quite a serious stimulus eventually transpire. But if in that case you wouldn't see iron ore at 150, you might see it back at 100 if it went sub 50 first. What we're looking at basically for the next 6 to 12 months in China is a very difficult period.
Fair enough. Got another question here from Ruth, who says, well, made a comment actually. Taiwan's semiconductor industry is the best in the world. Will China invade it to get a hold of it?
I don't think that's why they would invade Taiwan. Uh-huh. I think the reason to invade Taiwan is more political than it is economic. It is economic in the sense that these scenarios we've been discussing in terms of whether the Chinese economy stagnates does have direct political implications for the CCP, insofar as the lower the growth, the less political legitimacy it has, and so it needs to find other ways of propping up that legitimacy. One of those might be nationalism and a kind of greater China project, which, you know, absorbs Taiwan. I think that's the main danger for an invasion. Mm-hmm. That said, I mean, if I was American president, which I never will be, of course, and this transpired, then the first thing I would do is order the destruction of every semiconductor factory in Taiwan.
I'd fire my JDAMs
straight into those factories.
Yeah, but I think the other thing to remember is Taiwan is at the forefront of the semiconductor industry, but largely on an outsourced basis. So Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing, which is the biggest one over there and the best, doesn't do much of the design at all. They actually do almost no design. Most of the design comes from people like NVIDIA or AMD or other people who are outsourcing it to Taiwan. So, you know, you'd fully expect in that scenario that there would be a, I mean, there's already a big imperative to open up more semiconductor factories in the US and to transfer a lot of manufacturing. Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing themselves are building factories in the US. And so, you know, I would, whether it happened on day one or whether they needed time to get going, but there, at some stage there would be, I would expect a directive that you're no longer sending this, you know, the cutting edge stuff no longer goes to Taiwan. It now goes to places in the US.
Well, the quickest way for the US government to implement that would just simply say it's of strategic importance or something to that nature.
Yeah, exactly. They've already done it with a number of things where in terms of China, it wouldn't be very hard to then just make the same to Taiwan. There'd probably be there's obviously an interim step where they don't want the entire world's economy come crashing down, but these things are buildable elsewhere.
Well, we've got one from one of our own here. Jaden wants to know what's the timeline on the semiconductor shortage ending. He needs a new graphic card for his computer.
For his computer, yeah, it's keeps chasing their tail a bit over there. Look, I would say there's another probably 3 to 6 months to go. There's the new, you'll probably find, I think it's a little bit similar in terms of within another year and a half, I think you'll have a glut in terms of the new production capacity that's been put on. But yeah, short term, it's subject to a number of different issues and could finish sooner or later. But you know, the factories are out there being built to do this and to supply sort of more production. And so at some stage we're going to see too much. But you know, whether that happens in 3 months or not is hard to tell.
Yeah, it's like clockwork, the semi-cycle, and we are near the peak. But you know, predicting it within months is difficult.
Well, it's classic economic theory, isn't it? If there's a scarcity, price goes up, people come in,
yes.
Manufacturers. Then there's a glut, price goes down.
Yes.
Now, I think we had a question earlier on that might have disappeared of something about the Australian property market. Something about asking, is this going to be enough?
Before we actually started, somebody wanted to know, Patrick,
yes.
Wanted to know, could this have an impact on cracking the Australian property bubble?
Yes, it could. It could crack it another 40% higher, is my answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So they can't invest their money in China, they're going to bring it here, is what you're saying?
No. It's just... a lot of these scenarios we're talking about here, the most useful analogy is 2015, where, you know, we had very similar macro circumstances, both mm-hmm. in China and the US, and potentially in Australia. And that is, once the terms of trade shock comes out of a Chinese slowdown hits Australia, and by that I mean basically just collapsing commodity prices, which denuded the economy of income, then the RBA has no choice but to keep cutting because it's so deflationary, despite the falling currency, that it just keeps cutting and keeps cutting. And now, of course, we're at zero, so it can't cut. But what it will do is simply start giving the banks more free money or negatively priced money via some fabulous facility that'll enable them to cut, you know, fixed mortgage rates from what they are, they have been floating around 2% to 1%. And the end result of that will be, you know, capitalized into property prices again. As we saw after 2015, the 2015 shock, or when the 2012 shock began it, and then,
a more forward-looking government would do that, but also put in property price constraints to make sure that, you're trying to drive down the property, trying to drive down the interest rate to get the Aussie dollar down and to help the borrowing costs of companies and get companies to get out there and do more. You actually don't want an asset bubble, but from an economic point of view,
absolutely not.
The current government does seem to like asset bubbles and potentially quite, you know, Labor Party is probably just as likely to like asset bubbles. Slightly less likely.
Well, they've declared for them now.
Yeah. And so...
And the other thing is, because the structure of Australian monetary policy is broken, where you have cash rate being, lever being pulled by the RBA and macroprudential policy within APRA, and yes, they consult and everything, but I would argue that APRA is politically quite compromised versus the RBA. Mm. Its current chairman was appointed by Josh Frydenberg in the middle of the scandal of the Hayne Royal Commission. And so it was a massive personal favour that he needs to repay. And so there are political economy tensions within APRA that don't exist so much for the RBA. And so...
Well, we had Frydenberg out saying as well that not only APRA but ASIC as well have to both, you know, pull in the right direction and help growth.
Yes, they do. They're a wildly pro-property price government. They're not likely to stand in the way of it. I don't think Labor probably would either. You most certainly should slash rates, crash the dollar, and put in macroprudentials so that you push all of that easing into the currency. But I'd believe it when I see it.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It would be the intelligent way to get around it but that's not what, yeah. And it's quite interesting, though, when you look through the, there's two points as well I wanted to make about China is, one is Japan in 1986 had a very famous document sort of talking about all the problems in Japan and the right ways to get around those problems. And it sort of didn't start implementing them and sort of was late on, you know, the number of the ones that they eventually tried to get around to implementing over time was part of the reason why the Japanese downturn was as severe and as long as it was. But it does look as if China is following that path, exactly the same things that it said, this is what you need to do to fix your property sector. If your property sector has overtaken your economy and is become, you know, turned into the a parasite on the rest of the economy rather than sort of being an adjunct to the rest of the economy, then here's all the things you can do to try and get around that. Most of those same things apply to Australia and we're not in any way, shape or form looking to try and fix the problems. Just a step back and, you know, isn't it great how high property prices are, and maybe we'll let you tap your super to help you get into it if you haven't already got some.
Yeah.
All right. Before we go any further, just a quick check-in. Anybody have any final questions here? This would be a good time to get them in.
Except we're going to get the viewer question of the week while we're...
Yeah, we'll get into that. Why not? So I guess the viewer question of the week is quite simply this. Will China enter a hard landing, first and foremost? And which of these three scenarios that we've outlined here today do you think is most likely to happen? Of course, David has put probabilities against it, so that makes it a little bit easier, but you may not agree with him, simply put.
Excellent. Oh, well, I think that's probably it, Mark.
Yeah, wind it up.
Thanks. All right.
Thanks, absolutely.
Everyone. Yeah. So, well, ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the possible options for outcomes that we will see here. I hope you found the discussion enlightening and that it'll be of use to you to determine your own opinion. Thanks again to all of those who've watched this episode live and to all of those who've asked questions. We do welcome your feedback on this show and any suggestions for topics that you think we should cover. Don't forget to click like on the video right now. And finally, if you know anyone else who might get something from this webinar of today's episode, basically, share this with them. If you'd like to see more of our previous webinars, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. You can also stay up to date with news from us by following us on social media. Thank you once again for tuning in from myself, Mark, and the rest of the team, and we look forward to seeing you at the next one. Have a good day, good week, good month.